And how did you arrive at those parameters, and what's your sense about achieving them?
How I got to there was I was trying to find a set of one-liners that would encapsulate all the environmental values in a very small, simple place. A whole lot of code words, but they're coded in intelligible language. And as your understanding of the issues increases, then those words mean more and more and more and more. Because there are books and libraries full about each one of those lines. And from a sense of achievement, we've certainly well on the way to achieving step one, which is making it safe to swim. As soon as the pipeline goes in, that effectively is achieved. It's almost there at the moment because of the level of treatment being achieved in the pond, in the city's treatment system. So, I have to acknowledge that the treatment plant does work very well, and the plant operators and managers go to a lot of bother to make sure that it does work well. Sure, it stinks now and again, but these things happen. But they do generally try very hard to make it work well. So number one is almost in the bag. Number two comes will be in the bag when we get the when the ocean pipe is running and we're starting to make inroads into the river pollution. So that's getting on top of the last of the industrial pollution that's getting in, and the stormwater runoff from the rest of the community. But there are a number of little things that we could do that would make a big difference to that. But it's a question of how quickly do we want to achieve that, and that depends on a whole range of other things. Because just getting the waste out of the estuary is so significant. The other two, well, they'd be the icing on the cake. We don't necessarily have to make the shellfish safe to eat, but it's a good way of measuring how successful we are. It looks like if the shellfish are not catching or not concentrating anything, or if not finding it in there, then that means we've really done well. But if they are, it just means we have to try and do better. But don't necessarily have to spend millions of dollars. It's just figuring out how to, like, pick up the dog poos or something like that might be the critical factor. And the council can't pick up the dog poos. It's the dog poo people that need to pick it up.
And so the balance of care that there's the various groups that have had a concern and care for the estuary, individuals, and the various people working at the estuary and government agencies. But of course, there's the other consideration of the people who live in Christchurch and who visit the estuary. Is your what's your sense about them holding an awareness about the estuary and the importance of that?
I have to confess I haven't put a lot of effort into worrying about what other people think about it, or what they currently think about it. I've more concentrated on how valuable I think it is, and doing things that improve my perception of it. Because in a way, like, charity starts at home, I think environmental awareness starts at home as well. And so if I'm not addressing things like how big my footprint is, what impact I'm having, how can I say anything to anyone else if I'm a hypocrite?
Alex, I'm aware that we are running on. Would you like to round up now, or shall I continue putting some questions to you?
Have you got many more to go?
I was going to ask you some questions about peripheral issues to the estuary, I suppose, that there's, and then to just sum up, which we could do now, on some concluding comments.
Well, I'm spend another half hour or something like that, if you've got
all right.
Recording time.
I guess that what's become apparent to me is that there's that you've taken on this mammoth task and you're working your way through it, but around the corner there seems to be considerable new issues that are rearing their head, and you know that there's likely changes through climate change that's going to affect the estuary in the next 50 years. Is that something that the work of the trust or the work of people concerned about the estuary are keeping an eye on?
I think we're well.
Is a sense of that.
I think we're well aware of
rising
those
sea levels.
It can only get better for us because the estuary is going to get bigger if that happens. But that's a bit cynical. And I think it's a mix of we do have to live in the here and now, and it's very, very hard to get people to have a forward program that extends more than a few months or a year or two at most. The idea of having a 10-year long-term plan is completely foreign to a substantial part of the population. But personally, my horizon is actually in the thousands of years, and it's really simple to argue in support of that. And I don't actually know when people started, but we've got sort of written history goes back 2,000 years, say, to Christ, for argument's sake. So if our half life is 2,000 years, so that I think some really religious people say the world started about 4,000 years ago. I'm not saying they're wrong, but that gives me a way of getting a measure on the length of life. So if the world is only 4,500 years old, then Christ was 2,000 years ago. So our lifetime to now is 4,000 years. That would make a half life on that 2,000 years. That's why I picked the Christ one. So what happens if you go 2,000 years ahead? And it's kind of fun to play that game because oil was forgotten how long it was predicted to last, but it was somewhere to the middle of this century. We've got coal in New Zealand for about 500 years, which is only a quarter of my step forwards if we use it at the current rate. But we've got economists who only think in terms of growth. So if we had coal for 500 years and we had growth, you'd suddenly use it all up in 100 or 200 years. So we're now down to only a small fraction of looking forwards of how we're going to do stuff. And quite suddenly you realize that the primary source of energy is sunlight, because coal and oil are just stored sunlight. And so if we're trying to work out a whole bunch of environmental things, like how many people can you support on the earth, well, what are you going to do when you've used up all the stored reserves of oil and coal? Well, you're going to be in deep, deep trouble. So you've got to start figuring out soon how you're going to live with what arrives every day with sunlight. And that affects crops you grow, how much you convert into biofuel, how much you do whatever you do. I don't care what it is, but you've got to figure out how to live within your means at some point. And so all the things I've been working towards is making doing less harm with less so that we can enjoy it for longer.
Well, that's a very positive outlook, I would have to say, really, to be in consideration that far into the future.
Well, I think it's very short-sighted not to.
Are your concerns personally or in your role at the Trust concerned about including the degree to which some of the suburbs around the estuary are becoming so built up and continuing to be built up, and maybe you have a better knowledge about whether that will be restricted or is meeting its reaching limits?
It's very easy to get into I'm right, you're wrong, and it's counterintuitive to me to, as a sailor, to put a big building by the sea. For two reasons. One is it messes up the wind I want to use for sailing, and in the higher stories it's very, very noisy, so why would you build it that high anyway? And you can't go out inside and enjoy it. Like at ground level, the wind speed will be doing 10 or 15 knots and it's quite pleasant being outside, but higher up it could be doing 40 knots and it's very unpleasant in 30 or 40 knots of wind. So what's the point in being up there? Better off to live in an aeroplane. But anyway, no, I don't agree that buildings should be built by the estuary. I think it's lots of arguments about how you should or shouldn't go about planning. There's lots of arguments about what you should plan for and shouldn't plan for, and there's lots of arguments. I think, you know, it's a Pandora's box, and it's probably simplest not to open the box, but people don't have that level of self-control. They rip the top off the box and then wonder later why there's all these consequences. And that's and so by saying that, I'm really saying that I think the population of the world is already big enough, and I don't understand how the growth merchants plan to do anything when you know, we've got all these consequences of, or I see as consequences of big populations. How the heck can you grow it more? Where are you going to get, where are you going to put it? And do we want it here?
Well, I guess another thought that comes to mind is that if the food populations in the estuary increase, then those people wishing to draw on those food supplies is also likely to increase.
Yes, and that's another issue which I've tended to put in the too hard basket, because in some ways that would be a wonderful measure of success, because we'd made the food safe to eat. So you know, you're hoisted on your own petard when you achieve that, but it would be an achievement that in some ways that'd be good.
So your sense is more about that the forward movement is positive and getting in the direction where you want to go, and let's deal with that for the time being.
Yeah, and getting back to the building thing, if people want to put big buildings there, well, that's fine. They can go and do that. But the saving grace is buildings don't last forever. And the building can be taken down just as easily as it can be put up.
I was referring more to the suburbs and the amount that the suburbs are growing of Redcliffe and Sumner, and the amount of traffic that's moving back and forth across the causeway and those kinds of stresses and strains.
Well, that's an interesting debate. I haven't been too concerned about that, because there isn't that much more land that you can put houses on, and it becomes self-throttling, if you like, because there'll be very strong arguments put up against making the roads bigger so that people can drive bigger cars out. And the price of fuel is correcting the problem anyway. Making people think differently about how you transport people. So I'd be quite cautious about building more roads and more oil refineries at the moment. I don't think the oil men are as silly as we'd like to think they are. They stopped building oil refineries about a decade ago, because I think they knew the peak was coming. And so why put money into something that you're not going to get your money back out of? So it's one of the ways I describe myself is a black environmentalist. I'm quite interested in the economics of it. And it's kind of it's a nice diversion is to think about economics from an environmental point of view, and how are you going to get your investment back?
So talk to me a bit more about that, about explaining what you mean by a black environmentalist.
Well, it's important to think about the economics of life, if you like. And one of the earlier questions was about how did I come to this environmental point of view. Well, all that's happened is I've added environmental words to my point of view, which has always been something about economy. Why would you spend money on something if you can't get a return on your investment? And that's always been the way it was. Why would you buy something just to throw it away? And I've put myself through that experience just recently by buying two pairs of cheap shoes, and both of them are worn out or broken or something. So why when I bought them, you know, it was a conscious decision to decide whether these shoes would be worth buying or not, and I found out that they're not, so I won't be buying any more of those. That's what I mean about I'm quite open to doing experiments, but remember the results. So that's the way I organise my life. Like we bought a log fire when there was a gas used to come to the South Island on a ship, and there was a strike on the ship, and so it became painfully obvious that if we were to buy a gas fire, we were at the behest of the ship workers, or the ship owners, or somebody would have us in a cleft stick. So we bought a log fire. We ran that for 27 years, and I don't know what its design life was, probably 15, but we stretched it out to 27, and then we've moved to a heat pump. But we didn't. We have a gas fire as a reserve heating system, but it's only there as a reserve. We're not burning through gas. It's just there as an emergency. And so there's, you know, we've always had at least two ways of heating the house, but we make sure we get a return on our investment. Like I used to sweep the chimney every 3 months on the log fire, so it never got messed up. And you know, that's what I mean about, you know, like I bought a proper chimney brush so I could clean the thing. Didn't have to pay anyone else to do it. So for 27 years, clean my own chimney. And so it's money in the bank.
So that's a core of your personal philosophy, the economics of life.
Well, it's just economics, yeah. Economics of life is a much better, yeah.
Is that a mindset that you find you've met plenty of other people who have that mindset?
There's a few around. I don't know a lot of people that agree with me, but that's all right.
You mentioned earlier that a considerable amount of the work involved with the trust has been voluntary. And the trust has now been going since 2001, 2002.
2002.
And I get the impression that you are energetic about continuing.
Yeah.
What
What drives me?
yeah.
Oh, because we're winning. Because the processes we've put in place are effective, because we've been able to effect change, and it's just changing how people think about things, and being able to demonstrate that by thinking about them differently, you can often save a lot of money and get a better outcome, and you can get to do what you want, which
You can get to do what you want,
yes.
meaning in quality of life.
Yes. Yeah. For argument's sake, what's the point in having the biggest, flashiest car if you can only drive it at 10 kilometres an hour because everybody else is choking up the road? So it's how do you achieve being able to drive your big, flash car on the road when you want to? So my solution to that is I bicycle everywhere, except when I want to drive the big, flash car.
So, what is more significant, do you think, or are they equal? Is, people's attitudes and way of thinking about things, is that more important than having the knowledge, scientific evidence to shift points of view?
I would
Which do you
say
think's been?
it's important what people think, but you need the supporting evidence. Now, because thought comes first, so that's got to be the most important thing. What you do with the thought then becomes the secondary thing, which is supporting evidence or science or engineering or whatever.
Last
And
oh.
I was gonna sorry, and I was just gonna say, again, that's a religious overtone, but people talk about waiting to die to get to heaven. Well, I'm sorry, I'm living in heaven now. I'm not waiting till I die. Because why gamble on whether the religious people are right or wrong? Why not enjoy it now? And so it's much simpler to do things that make it heaven on earth. Why talk about it? Why not do it?
The last question that comes to mind is that you mentioned those four stages, and you also spoke about your own experience of living alongside predominantly Maori communities. So that last reference in your four stages refers to
Mahinga
mahinga kai and a measure of living in a good place from the point of view of the Maori. To what degree has there been consultation, and in what degree do you see that as being an important aspect of getting the job done?
I'm going to say very important. But you have to be aware or understand that we have done some terrible things to the estuary from a Maori perspective. And the Maoris moved out a long time ago, and they've suffered the indignity for a very long time of having their estuary treated as a sewer. Now, asking Maoris to come back and help fix it is counterintuitive. That isn't going to happen in 100 years. We have to fix up what we stuffed up. And so the attitude I've adopted is I am saying that I'm going to be the what's the word? The facsimile Maori. Because I think I understand their attitudes and aspirations are little enough to understand what it is they don't like and do something about correcting those. So one of my personal goals is to make it so that, so the people who were displaced can feel like they can return. And come a long way in getting towards that goal.
Is there anything else that you'd like to talk about or add, Alex? I've been firing questions at you, so I'll give you a moment to think about that.
I think one of the other long-term things that I've been thinking about for a while is the with the estuary, when it was highly polluted, it was, there were a lot of people who wouldn't come there anyway because it was polluted. So there's a Maori involvement, there's also European involvement, you know, because it's sort of socially offensive to be swimming in shit. So when that situation has changed, I'm predicting a huge demand in access to the estuary, and so you suddenly have a whole different paradigm of problems to deal with. And when you look at the estuary, it's blindingly obvious that nobody has thought how people are going to get access to the estuary. We've got 2/3 of it has got roadway, and only 1/3 of it is generally accessible, which is, well, and even that's not truly accessible because of, and that's on the inside of the sand spit. And then along the ponds, you're shut out because of health and safety reasons with the ponds. There's a little bit of access from the windsurf area, a little bit of access at Scott Park where Mount Pleasant Yacht Club is, and then a little bit of access at Christchurch Yacht Club. But the rest of it is basically shut off, either by private property or by roadway, and no shoulder for parking. So I'm going to say it's blindingly obvious to me that whoever is looking after the big picture hasn't been looking at the big picture. So if you were looking at it in economic terms, we've spent something like $100 million on the pipeline and upgrades and stuff to make the estuary a nicer place, but we've spent nothing on how to manage the improved asset. I'm not saying we should spend money on it, but I'm just saying we appear to have not spent any money on it. So it's like, how do we go about recovering our investment in the pipeline if we don't look at access? And it's too easy to be critical about the City Council, and I'm not intending to be critical. I'm simply saying that access to the estuary is going to become a big issue. Can't think of anything else at the moment. I'm sure there could be probably 100 hours of interview if you really tried, but though I think we've covered most of the main things. Can't think of anything else. There's nothing burning that I can. I know, only one other sort of really summing up thing. In the first years of the life of the trust, we were rushing around fighting fires, and then we moved into backburning, so fight fire with fire, and now we're moving into fire prevention in a sort of a strategic thing. And it's kind of nice to be getting into the thing we were moving into fire prevention as opposed to actually having to fight fires.
And is that both within the trust and in
yes.
who you're working
yeah.
with?
Yeah.
So
it's I think we can I can go away feeling some level of satisfaction and being part of the process of achieving that.
So there's some sense of satisfaction and pride about the way that the trust operates as a group.
I think so.
All right. Well, thanks very much.
Pleasure.
We'll call it a day.
Okay.
And we'll stop the interview there.